The title in the abstract, which I submitted to Kai and Amanda, was Characterizing Quantum Correlations for a Given Causal Structure. And I tried to make that title intentionally ambiguous, because you could interpret that as saying, can I come up with some inequalities or constraints or characterization of all of the quantum correlations, so that if they are quantum, they're inside this set, and if they're non-quantum, they're outside that set? Or do I mean quantum in the sense of non-classical? So what we really want to do is derive inequalities which constrain classical distributions so that you can recognize when you have a quantum distribution in the sense that it's uniquely quantum. And it turns out that this technique that I'm going to explain can do both. It can achieve some characterizations of the set of all quantum correlations, and it can also distinguish between quantum and classical correlations. So it's a kind of nice feature. It might not be familiar that phrases like non-locality, no signaling, quantum correlations can be recast in the language of causal structure. So we take Bell's usual theorem, where you have Alice and Bob, and they're considered to be space-like separated, and Alice and Bob are choosing measurements supposedly at exactly the same time, so that there's not enough time for a light signal to propagate between Alice and Bob, and they get their outcomes quite quickly, so that it's inconceivable that Alice's choice of measurement should somehow impact the outcome that Bob sees on his system. But they're measuring these entangled systems, so there was some prepared resource which was distributed to them. Then the kind of correlations that we can observe, if it's a legitimately quantum system, are supposedly incompatible with some concrete assumptions. And that's what Bell's theorem usually does. And the assumptions that go into Bell's theorem might be phrased this in terms of these three axioms. So there's locality, or the non-signaling assumption, which is that the choice of the measurement setting doesn't influence the measurement outcomes of the other party. There's realism, which is to say that if you want to treat everything in a classical world, then whatever the shared resource is that Alice and Bob have access to, it should be described as some distribution over ontic states with who knows how many parameters, but there's some hidden configuration out there which is what is generating the correlations between them. And then the notion of measurement independence, which is to say that this state that they share, whether it's a classical randomness, that they're both seeing some outcome of a dice roll, or they're measuring entangled photons, that the system that's handed to them doesn't control how they choose to make their measurements. This sort of non-superdeterminism, that it's not as though in the beginning of the universe it was decided that on such and such a day this quantum system will be generated, because when Alice and Bob choose their measurements, everything's going to conspiratorially work out. But these notions can be rephrased more compactly if we just draw a picture. And that's to say, this is how we understand influences to be working. A and B would be sort of the outcome for Alice, the outcome for Bob. Alice's outcome, which is some number, depends on the shared resource and how she chooses to measure it, which is her measurement setting X. Bob's outcome depends on whatever setting he chooses, which is freely chosen as Y. And X and lambda, which is sort of the common cause here, are independent. X does not influence B. B is not a function of X. Right? And so this picture, which is what we call a directed acyclic graph, in the sense that it keeps track of how causal influences work together. You wouldn't imagine that you have a cause which goes to effect, which then sort of loops back into the cause. So there's no cycles. But it tracks more broadly than functional dependencies, causal dependencies, all the ways that influences could possibly have impact down the line. And the collection of the axioms that go into Bell's theorem sort of force you to this conclusion of causal structure. But you might have already reached this causal structure conclusion for how you want to describe the quantum experiment, even if you weren't thinking about free will and special relativity, only because you know that Alice works in one building, Bob works in the other building. And the only thing that happens is these fiber optic cables coming into their labs. And it would be sort of strange to presume that there's some weird signaling going on, that some radio wave is propagating when Alice chooses a measurement. So even if you don't have all this space-like separation and rigid, oh, it must be a Bell experiment, there's still reasons to think, I believe that my experiment is being described in such a way, because you go to the lab, that seems, sounds reasonable. There's a whole other motivation for it, which comes from some work by Rob and Chris Wood, where they sort of say the distributions that you see, if you want to talk about any possible causal explanation which could account for the correlation that you're seeing, you're going to end up concluding that this is really the only starting point to even talk about. But the point here is that when we talk about local correlations, classical correlations versus quantum correlations, what we really mean in a Bell scenario is if the correlation is compatible with this Dirac-Dec acyclic graph in standard causal inference statistics, then it's a local distribution. It's reasonable and can be explained with a local hidden variable model. If you have a distribution which is incompatible with this causal structure, then it's a non-local distribution. So the goal here is to be able to start with a given structure, such as the Bell scenario causal structure, come up with some inequalities which characterize the set of distributions which could be compatible with that causal structure, whatever causal structure you're studying. And then you can get a picture of this is the set of distributions which are compatible. And you can get sort of the local set of distributions. And we've done this very well when we talk about Bell scenarios, in the sense that we recover Bell inequalities. So you start with the picture of the Dirac-Dec acyclic graph. There's some machinery which we can get into, which gives you stuff like in terms of expectation values, if Alice is using x as her setting, then her expectation value, if you treat her a as a plus one, minus one, whether it's going to be the same as Bob, you can work that out, and you find out that there's this bound of two. And you don't need any quantum physics for that. You can go to a standard statistician who's never heard of any quantum theory, show them the Dirac-Dec acyclic graph, and say, what are the possible implications? And they'll give you the same inequality. And as a result of having a description and understanding of what are the distributions which are now constrained to be compatible with this, we find out that some distributions, for example, the PR box, where you have in the three out of four possible pairings of settings that Alice and Bob could be choosing to measure with, that they are correlated. But if they happen to choose this one pair, let's say they're both on their second measurement choice, then their outcomes are anti-correlated. This is impossible, and that would be a non-local distribution in the sense that it's incompatible with this Dirac-Dec acyclic graph because it violates the inequalities. So we want to generalize this. So suppose we want to, over the course of this talk, consider something like the triangle scenario, which is a whole new ballgame where you've got sort of three sources which we're going to imagine are classical, and then what if they're not classical, and three parties. There's no measurement settings here, so Alice just takes in some input. And we're going to derive polynomial inequalities. So these are linear inequalities. These are nonlinear inequalities. And from these nonlinear inequalities, we can show that various probability distributions are not possible. They are not local or not classically compatible with a given causal structure. So here's a bit of background information as to why this is not such a simple problem. Most of the time, if you are given a causal structure in practice and you want to know, is this particular distribution, say, compatible with a causal structure, the first thing you look at are the conditional independence relations which are implied by a causal structure. And so here, this picture tells you that x and y, if you just look at them, they should be statistically uncorrelated because there's no common cause which could give a correlation and one doesn't influence the other. Moreover, if you condition on, let's say, Bob's outcome, then actually whether you condition on Bob's outcome or not, there's not going to be any correlation between Bob's measurement choice analysis measurement outcome. That's what we call sort of no signaling assumption. If you find that those conditional independence relationships are violated, obviously you're not compatible with the causal structure. And so in the class of causal structures, the first thing you do is you work through what are the conditional independence relationships implied by the causal structure, and does your distribution satisfy that? And this is used in machine learning. If you want to have a car which is driving around, mapping its environment with lasers, it's going to consider various hypotheses, which it's going to consider, come up with models, and it's going to use this as a way of testing. The problem with this is there is no difference between quantum and classical correlations at this level. If you have a scenario where the resource is a classical hidden random variable, or if it's an entangled quantum system, either way, the kind of correlations that you could get, quantum experiment or classical experiment, the conditional independence relationships are always going to hold. And so they cannot be used as a measure to distinguish them, and they can't be used as a criterion for what constitutes local as opposed to quantum. Another sort of problem is that if we wanted to talk about, say, this scenario, even if I didn't tell you that conditional independence relationships always are satisfied even by quantum resources, there are no conditional independence relationships which can be observed in this scenario, and yet there are correlations which can't be achieved. So we need to go to a finer grained description, and this is what motivates the polynomial inequalities. The other reason it's a little bit tricky here is that when we talk about Bell scenarios, you have one latent node, which is the sort of the common cause. It's the system that was prepared and that Alice and Bob both have access to. And because it's in this particular form, then any correlation, AB given X and Y, should be written as some functional dependence where A depends on X and this hidden random variable's value, where B is a function of Y and its thing, and this could be sort of probabilistic dependencies, and then the various probabilities that you could imagine for this variable to take, choices of lambda, and you can consider all possibilities. But this essentially just tells you that you're considering combinations of product distributions. So if we just look at sort of this, these two terms here, it's a product distribution, and the integration here is that we're mixing product distributions. So to be Bell local, and this is sort of Fine's theorem stated in a strange way, if it can be written as a combination of product distributions, then it's compatible with the Bell scenario. And then you can work through and you can say, okay, what are the extremal product distributions? And they would be sort of the deterministic ones, and there are 16 of those. And then you find out that if your probability distribution lies in the convex span of these particular 16 product distributions, then it's Bell local, and if not, it's not. And so the whole problem just ends up being sort of a convex Hall enumeration because everything's a convex polytope. When we talk about scenarios like the triangle scenario, we're in trouble because it's no longer an integral over a single variable, so it's not just a combination of stuff. The set of distributions which are compatible with or sort of a general causal structure is not a convex set of distributions, and it's certainly not going to be described by linear inequalities. You're going to need polynomial inequalities. So the techniques to generate the constraints are going to be need to be different techniques. So here's the one that we're going to introduce. We start with the causal structure that you'd like to constrain, and then we imagine modifying it in principle. So here's the triangle scenario where you have Alice, and Alice is a function of these X and Y hidden variables. If this was in fact happening, if your distribution was being generated by this causal structure, then there would have to be some model, some probabilistic dependence, which I could say, this is how Alice depends on X and Y, so that everything can be recovered. Right? There would be sort of a black box physical implementation where you would give me these, and I could take wires, and they would sort of feed into these other boxes, and then I can see some outcomes and not others, but they exist. If they do, then I could create something like this. I could say, whatever functional dependence gave me A here, let me create another copy of y, which I can do. It's just some random variable. I could prepare it twice. And now I can create another copy of Alice, which also takes in this copy of x, but now a different copy of y. And this is something I hypothetically could construct. In the inflation, we'd like to draw it in such a way that every variable has exactly the same dependencies as it did originally. So if we had a node, which was a root node here, then when we consider it or its copies, it should also be a root node. If we have a node in the inflation DAG, DAG is directed acyclic graph, it's an acronym, it should have the same parents. So B always has a Y and a Z parent, and here this B has a Y and a Z parent, here this B has a Y and a Z parent. So whatever the functional dependencies are and whatever the distributions of the hidden variables are, if they're going to make this work, then this would work too. And this lets us now create a link between the DAG that we started with and the inflation DAG in terms of the probabilities of the things that we can see. So the probability distribution for the random variable A1 in this DAG, we can take it to be exactly the same as the probability distribution of A in this DAG, because we've, by construction, assumed that all the latent variables, all the root nodes have the same dependencies, have the same distribution as they did in the original, and all the functional dependencies are preserved. But it goes a little bit more than one observable random variable at a time. We can consider certain subsets. So take a look at C2 and B1. C2 and B1, if we look at them, C2 has a Z and an X as a parent, B has a Z and a Y as a parent. Moreover, this Z is the same Z for C and B, but that's basically just this graph if I ignore A for a second, right? So if I look at the subgraph of X, C, Z, B, Y, and the subgraph of X2, C2, Z1, B1, and Y1, they're really the same thing. And so the assumption that all the functional dependencies are preserved means that the distribution over B1 and C2 is the same as the distribution over B and C as it would have been in the original DAG. If I had a way of constructing it and I were to do this, that's what it would be. And the distribution over A1, C1, B1 all together, if I sort of look at that three variable multivariate distribution, it's going to have the same multivariate distribution as A, B, and C were originally here. But not everything goes. So if you look at the example here is A1, B1, C2. So A1, B1, C2. Here, A1 depends on this x and this y. C2 depends on this z and this x. In the original scenario, while C and A both depend on a variable called x, it's the same variable x. So A and C have a common parent. Here, A and C, if I look at A1 and C2, they don't. The parents of A1 are these two. The parents of C2 are those two. A1 and C2 are independent in the inflation DAG. So it would not be fair to say that this multivariate probability distribution over A1, B1, C2 is the same as ABC. It's not. Yeah. And we can make this a bit more formal, and we can say, what are the sets of variables, subsets of variables, in the inflation DAG such that they must have the same probability distribution as they would have had in the original? And the conclusion is basically, you just look at the subgraph. If you look at the subgraph of, of a set U in the inflation DAG, So the ancestor subgraph in G prime, and it matches up with that same set if you looked at its ancestral subgraph in your original graph. And by matching up, I just mean up to dropping the indices. Then this is one of those things where all the functional dependencies are the same, and so they should have the same distribution. And there's more than one way to phrase this in practice. So a set will be called an injectable set, which is the name for these special subsets like A1, B2, but not A1, B1, C2, the injectable sets. If the ancestors of some set U in the inflation deck, because the injectable sets are always variables with the subscripts, they always live in the inflation deck, are irredundant, which means that they don't have two variables with the same original variable but different subscripts. So in this case, when we looked at A1, C2, B1, it was redundant because there were two X's. When that happens, the A1, C2 isn't going to be injectable. And another condition is that if you can just check that some multivariable set U prime, you look at its pairs, if all the pairs are themselves injectable sets, then the whole thing is injectable, if and only if. So in this particular inflation DAG, which is a spiral sort of shape for the triangle scenario, there are precisely four maximal pre-injectable sets. Anything larger than these four, if I try to add anything, another variable to any of those four sets, it no longer is injectable. It no longer satisfies these properties. Now, what's the connection useful for? Is that there's a certain kind of logic that we go through. We say, if you have a specific probability distribution in mind, right, not abstract, but actual data, and if it was generated by a particular causal structure G, it's compatible with causal structure G, then you could look at the injectable sets, you could assign them whatever probability distributions they should have, because they would be sort of all of the marginal distributions of this original probability distribution. And that set of marginal distributions over the pre-injectable sets will be compatible with the inflation deck. So compatibility of a distribution with the original DAG means necessarily compatibility of the pre-injectable sets, marginal distributions over them, with this other causal structure. And this is useful because we're going to try to work backwards. We're going to say, if I can find constraints easily on the inflation DAG, I can make conclusions from them about what is and isn't possible in my original DAG by sort of a reducio ad absurdum. So here's another bit of logic. If I have a specific probability distribution which is compatible with my original DAG, and moreover, I also have as a given, some inequality, some constraint, which only references pre-injectable sets. So there's probability distribution over this pre-injectable set, maybe minus probability distribution over a different pre-injectable set with a different outcome, whatever it might be. And this inequality in the abstract, so not for a particular distribution, but for any probability distribution, it must be satisfied for these probability distributions to be compatible with the inflation DAG. So this is a condition which is satisfied by all distributions in the inflation DAG, well, then it's going to also be satisfied when you take this inequality and you plug in the specific distribution over the pre-injectable sets. And this is the last bit of logic, and it sort of is where we're going. So if we have one of these necessary inequalities, which is required to be true for compatibility with the inflation DAG, but this is a special kind of inequality which only talks about pre-injectable sets, and it's violated by some particular distribution, then that distribution must not be compatible with your original DAG, because it's just sort of the converse. And this lets us do a lot of fun things. So here's an example where we're going to illustrate the utility. Here's the triangle scenario, and here's a distribution which we'd like to know might it happen. So this is perfect correlation, or GHZ after the GHZ state, which is to say, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, they don't talk to each other, They just each have access to some cause. So there's no common cause which Alice, Bob, and Charlie all have access to, but imagine there's classical shared randomness. So there's some random number generator, which called Y, that Alice and Bob get to see the outcome of. And there's a different random generator, Z and X. And in each run of this supposed game, each party sees two of these random sources. Can they, without communicating, announce outcomes such that they all yield zero, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, or they all yield one? And they do this where they don't always just yield zero, but half the time they do all zero, half the time they do one. Is it possible? So this is not a super trivial question to answer, but we can use inflation as a way to sort of make inferences about this. So here's the original scenario. And we say, okay, let's consider some inflation of it. So this is the inflation that I want to consider now, where we just sort of split it and create one preparation of Z1 and a different Z2. And we have this B depend on Z2 and this C depend on that Z. So writing it out, it's going to look like this. And now we're going to start and we're going to say, let's make up inequalities which must hold for any probability distribution over here, however trivial they are, and work backwards. We have to make sure that the inequality only addresses pre-injectable sets. So here's the way we're going to start. We're going to say the probability of, in this causal structure, getting B2, A1, and C1 to give you the outcomes A, B, and C, respectively, must be positive. Well, yeah. Moreover, we're going to say that the probability of getting anything but A and anything but C and anything but B is also a positive probability. And I can write that in terms of the probabilities of A, B, and C as opposed to the probabilities of not A, not B, and not C. So this whole term must be positive. Okay, great. And moreover, in this particular inflation, B2 and C1, if we just look at them, they're completely independent. They have no common cause. They have no influence one to the other. So the marginal distribution over B2 and C1 factorizes. These are truths, almost tautologically true. I'm not doing any sort of hard work here, for things to be compatible with this. But when I take these three sort of obvious truths and I combine them, I sum the two inequalities and I make a substitution here, I derive this inequality. And this inequality is exactly the sort of thing that we're looking for. It's necessary in the sense that any distribution which is compatible with the inflation tag must satisfy this, but it's only in terms of pre-injectable sets. So now we can answer the question. We take a look at our distribution, and we go back and we say, what would this inequality evaluate to? So let's work it out. The probability that Alice, one, this particular copy in the inflation tag, gets outcome one, if this is the distribution in the original DAG, well, A1 just matches up to A, so that would be 1/2, right? And this would be 1/2, and this would be 1/2. And then here it would be A1, B2 is an injectable set, so the distribution is the same as A and B. And it asks, can you get A being 1 and B being 0? Well, that never happens. So this is going to have values 0 and 0. And then this would be 1/2 times 1/2. So it's going to end up being 1 minus 1/2 minus 1/2 minus 1/2 plus 0 plus 0 plus 1/4, which works out to minus 1/4, which is not bigger than 0. And as a result, I've concluded that this perfect correlation must not be possible from the triangle scenario, because if it were, then I should be able to consider what it would look like in the inflation bag, but it violates this truism in the inflation bag. But here's where it gets fun. Instead of looking at a particular distribution, once I have an inequality, which is in terms of pre-injectable sets, it must hold for all distributions, not just this one. And so we do this sort of backwards logic, and we say, from something that must have been true in the inflation DAG, I now have a constraint on the original. And so here I've dropped the subscripts. And this inequality is a polynomial inequality, which is necessary for compatibility with the triangle scenario. So this is something that we derived. It's not that hard. It's like a three-step process. But it's a polynomial inequality, which must be satisfied by all distributions that are compatible with the triangle scenario. This one is not. Therefore, this distribution is not compatible with the triangle scenario. And this is sort of how we go about doing things. And the starting point for when we say, give me an inequality in terms of pre-injectable sets on the inflation DAG. Who says anything about probabilities? It could be anything you want. So we can repeat the argument in terms of entropies. This is a entropic inequality, which holds true for any three variables. And so we're going to consider A1, B2, and C1. But it has nothing to do with causal structure. Anytime you have three random variables, the sum of two mutual informations minus the sum of mutual information are going to be less than the entropy of the one that doesn't appear here. That's always true for any probability distribution. In this particular causal structure, C1 and B2 are independent, and so their mutual information would have to be zero for any probability distribution, which means that a constraint on this causal structure is this. But this is only in terms of pre-injectable sets. So I can drop this notion about treating it as an inequality in the for the inflation DAG and just move it in as an inequality for the original DAG. And this is called what we call monogamy of correlation, that you can't have correlations strong between B and C and also strong between B and A to a certain degree. Because if B and C are extremely correlated, it means that B is paying more attention to Z than it is to Y. It has more of an impact on B's distribution, and then A and B cannot be so correlated. So it's not surprising, but it's just a way of getting there. And we can actually derive a whole bunch of inequalities. So I'm not going to go through all the steps, but for the triangle scenario, here's an inequality, which can be derived from inflation. There's another inequality which can be derived from inflation. And in the paper that we sort of haven't quite published, yeah, we've got a list of some 30-something inequalities, all polynomial inequalities, which are derived in this method. But there's nothing special about the triangle scenario. The technique is general enough that we can go back and recover all of the Bell inequalities. So here's the original Bell scenario, right? Here is an inflation of it. So now, let's just derive things which are obviously true on the inflation, make sure they're in terms of the injectable sets, and see what we can get. And so, in the interest of time, I'm probably not going to go through the full step, but this is an inequality which is true for anything. It has nothing to do with causal structure, it's just a tautology. And then, if we consider the way that it should factorize according to this particular causal structure, we obtain this, give it a little manipulation, and it turns out that this is an inequality on this, which is very easy to get to, just by standard logic. But it's only in terms of pre-injectable sets, which means that this inequality is true, but that's just the CHSH inequality. So there it is. And moreover, and again, I'm not going to give the proof now, it can be shown that this idea about using inflation and making backwards inferences will recover, in principle, every Bell inequality for every scenario. So there's no loss of generality in considering things like this. Let me summarize for a second the general outline of how it works. You start with weak constraints on the inflation DAG variables. The constraints that you just chuck in, what, if you want to say like they're entropic or probability, whatever they are, they're usually going to involve sets of variables which are not just injectable sets. So then you have to do some massaging, and you have to identify what are the injectable sets and get rid of the other things. So you have a whole bunch of inequalities, and now you're going to mix, match, and draw inferences from them to obtain inequalities which only pertain to the injectable sets. So basically, there are probability distributions over the sets which are not injectable, but because I don't know what they would be, I have to get rid of them, and so they just exist out there, and it's a form of quantifier elimination. And it can be recast as linear quantifier elimination, but then you obtain these inequalities in terms of just injectable sets. So I alluded to in the beginning the fact that we wanted to characterize quantum correlations in two senses. We wanted to say, what are inequalities such that for classical compatibility with a causal structure, these must be satisfied? And now maybe these inequalities will be violated if the resources are quantum. But also we'd like to have some notion of an inequality which is satisfied by all distributions which you would get if you replaced the classical variables in a causal structure with quantum resources. So in the Bell scenario, we'd be talking about going from saying that the right-hand side is capped by 2 to capped by 2 root 2, which is Thurlestone's band. So saying that it's less than root 2 is a classical inequality. It constrains the classical distribution. Saying that it's 2 root 2 subsumes the quantum distribution. So here's how we can use inflation to both ends. If this is our original DAG, and we do an inflation like this, physically, what this means is that there is this system X1, and now it's being sent out to A1 and A2. So A2 is supposed to have the same dependence on X1 and Y2, and A1 has the dependence on X1 and Y1, but they're using the same X1. This operation cannot be physically performed if this is a quantum system. You can't just send it, the part that would have gone to one Alice, to multiple Alices, because you can't, it's broadcasting the state. If you could do that, then all the different Alices could measure in different bases, and you'd have all sorts of issues with complementarity and stuff like that. But the point is, this is the problem. It's because we have two red arrows coming out of the X. It's not that we duplicated Y, because if we have Y, which is some quantum state, I could just prepare it again. So duplicating some distribution, whether it's hidden or not, that's perfectly fine physically. But the conclusions that I draw then, if I say, well, I could do this, those conclusions are only valid under the assumption that I'm treating everything classically. So if X is classical, then we can just retransmit whatever it is, which is some ontological state here. But if it's quantum, we cannot. And therefore, whenever we assume that we could have done that, we're assuming that the logic here requires an assumption of classicality. And so the constraints that are derived are constraints which are limited to classical correlations. Here, though, is an inflation, it's a use of the inflation technique where we've duplicated Z, but we no longer are taking one of these systems and sending it to multiple copies of the same part. It's not two Alices or two Bobs from the same latent variable. So there's no notion about broadcasting a quantum state here. And so if I take this inflation DAG and I walk through some logic and make conclusions, then it's going to hold, even in the GPT paradigm. So this inequality we derived a few slides back for the triangle scenario, it holds even if you were to replace these with quantum resources. And that's kind of interesting because it tells you that this notion of perfect correlation is impossible whether or not you try to make it use of entanglement and non-locality and all that sort of thing. You very well can get to distributions in the triangle scenario with quantum resources that you could not in the classical sense. It's a larger set, but this isn't in that set either. And we can sort of formalize this. The inflation is of the non-broadcasting type whenever the latent node in the inflation DAG, if you look at its children, you have this irredundancy, no two copies. And then all the conclusions you could draw from that go through in all GPTs. You can be a little bit fancier if you want, and if your goal now is to derive inequalities which hold for all GPTs, you can still consider a directed acyclic inflation, which has some of this broadcasting, but your starting inequalities hold true only on non-broadcasting subsets. And so if you have a set of nodes which you want to talk about in some larger DAG, you just look at the sort of ancestors there, its ancestral subgraph. And if that doesn't involve any notion of broadcasting, then it's still reasonable that the conclusions, like these are all positive, it's going to hold true, and the logic works down. So that when we are working with GPT versus quantum things, we start with these inequalities which generally speaking contain non-injectable sets, and we do quantifier elimination to make them only injectable sets left over. We should not allow inequalities to start with all the non-injectable sets. We should only allow them to start with non-broadcasting sets if we want to derive an inequality which is valid for quantum resources and GPTs. All right, so that's really the end of things. Final summary. If you want to derive constraints on the original DAG, all you need to do is consider weak constraints on the inflation DAG, and then this converse kind of logic will take those weak constraints and sort of upgrade them. So things which were obvious on the inflation DAG lead us to things which were not at all obvious for the original DAG. The initial constraints that go in to this sort of logical process don't need to be in terms of probabilities. We find that that's appears to be the most powerful way to do it, but it can be done with entropies, it can be done with any causal constraint that you'd like, so long as you can move it into some form where you only reference injectable sets so that the distributions can match up. And then how you want to get rid of the quantifiers is also a choice, because you can say, I'm only going to use linear quantifier elimination. It's computationally easy. So if you do that, if you start with a set of nonlinear inequalities and you apply only linear quantifier elimination to get rid of these non-injectable sets, you might end up with a set of constraints which are all true, but if you would have done nonlinear elimination, you would have found stronger or tighter conditions. But whatever. It still gives you polynomial inequalities in the end. You can perform quantifier elimination, which is not always the easiest thing. And if it's just too complicated, you can forget all about it and just do satisfiability checking. So the idea here is you have a causal structure, which is a hypothesis, and you have a particular probability distribution, and you want to know, does this distribution come from this causal structure? Yes or no, is it possible? And what you do then is you consider some inflation, write down obviously true constraints on the inflation DAG. They're going to involve quantifiers. They're going to involve probabilities or entropies in terms of these non-injectable sets. Doesn't matter. Take a look at those things which you do know, the injectable distributions, and say, is there any distribution over the other stuff such that these constraints are satisfied? And you'll get a yes or no result. And that's the same as doing the quantifier elimination and then substituting the thing. So if you have a particular distribution in mind, you don't actually have to do any quantifier elimination. You can just start with these inequalities which involve injectable and non-injectable stuff and just do satisfiability checking, which is really very, very easy to do. We've used it in practice. So not only did we get these sort of polynomial constraints, but there's this distribution here, which is with the W distribution after the W state. And so you have the three parties, two of them always yield zero, while one of them always yields one, but which one yields one is totally random. This distribution violates this polynomial inequality which we derived, and so this distribution we showed is not possible in the triangle scenario. As far as I can tell, there's no previous work which was able to show that this distribution is not compatible with the triangle scenario. Anything having to do with entropic inequalities won't work, because if you just look at the entropies of this distribution, it entropies match up beautifully, exactly, with another distribution which is achievable. So if you just look at the entropies, it's going to give you a false negative and say there's no problem. But there is a problem. That's pretty much it. The work is not currently published. So if you'd like a copy, let me know. I'll print you out one. But that's it.
Questions? No, I'll start with a quick one. Is there a hand up over there?
Sure. So you said that for the Bell scenario, you can get all the Bell inequalities.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that for any DAG, you can, in principle, if you use all the right inflations, you can get all of the constraints?
What a good question. I can't say no, but I'm not sure if I would go so far as to say I think yes. At this point, we don't have any evidence which says it's impossible to do so. And here's an argument sort of sketched in favor of saying that yes, you could. With a sufficiently large inflation, imagine that you were physically doing this. So instead of having this one scenario where you have one outcome for Alice, but now you've made all these different copies of Alice in the triangle scenario, all these different copies of Bob, and all the different ways that the latent variables can be constructed, then imagine it to the limit where you have millions of Alices and millions of Bobs and millions of every observable node that you had in the original. You've taken tons and tons and tons of copies and created this massive inflation by wiring things up. Then when you do a single run of that experiment, where the latent variables take on particular values and you get a particular set of outcomes, all the statistics will be accessible to you immediately. You don't have to do repeated runs. So what's the marginal distribution analysis? Well, it's the fraction that got this outcome versus that outcome, right? And moreover, you should be able to infer all of the functional dependencies. Because if, let's say, that the latent variables could take up to 20 different values, and that could completely explain everything that you see, then if you have millions and millions and millions of instances, then you can cluster them in terms of, well, this sort of set of outcomes happened versus this set of outcomes happened versus this, and you can start partitioning it and figuring out the exact relationships. And if you could access these functional dependencies, then you would recover the specific causal model, not just the causal structure, and that would definitely give you a yes, that this is possible. So in that sense, we would imagine that such an inflation, if you could, without putting in a particular distribution or constructing it, derive all the constraints that would be implied if you could do such a thing, that might be necessary and sufficient. But it's speculative. I'm not 100% sure.
I think it's worth saying there's also some DAGs where it's not clear whether you even get known constraints, like the instrumental DAG.
Right.
So it's conceivable that it could give all the constraints for some DAGs, but for other DAGs, it doesn't give you all the constraints.
Also true. Yeah, so the instrumental scenario, let me have a copy of that. I think that's it. Maybe this is the wrong one. Yeah. We've looked at various. This has a conditional independence relation. Well, no, there's no sort of observable one. but not all probability distributions between A, B, and C, which are observed, are allowed here. And there's the instrumental inequalities for bid sum. Even though, even if I condition on B, A and C can still be correlated, because when I do sort of post-selection by looking at B having a particular value, that means that it's more likely for X to have a particular value and more likely that A had a particular value, because A was apparent and X was apparent, so that induces a correlation between A and X and therefore a correlation between A and C. But even in this scenario, it's not true that all the distributions over A, B, and C are possible. Some inequalities are known. We have not been able to recover the instrumental inequalities yet using the function.
I'm surprised by that because this is very similar to the Bell scenario.
Yeah. We can sort of recover them if we make assumptions about the cardinality of the latent variable, and maybe those are justified at the moment, but...
The connection to the Bell scenario, I guess, would be if you duplicate B, and you think of your second copy as B is just acting on C, then that's sort of the setting. If you take the Bell scenario and you say, oh, the outcome on Alice's side is going to become the setting on Bob's side, then you get this. But the problem is that such a thing is not an inflation, right? Like if I make a second copy of B and say it's a root node in the new DAG, well, it doesn't have the same ancestors as A and X anymore. So that kind of trick would not, it's not the kind of thing we're looking at. It may still be true that this idea of the connection could get us there, but just saying maybe that the obvious way of doing it is to turn this, it might look as if you could turn this into the Bell scenario just by splitting B. That doesn't satisfy our definition of inflation.
Any other questions?
Do you have any thoughts on the notion of uniqueness in terms of inflation, in the sense that when you have these inequalities over the pre-injectable sets in the inflation, if there was more than one original DAG that had the same inflation, would you end up deriving sort of constraints on multiple sets of original DAGs? Like, just, even though they have different causal structure, right? You know, you found inequalities that work for all of them.
I'm not sure whether that is a meaningful question in the sense that for any inflation, if I just look at the inflation DAG, there is only one original DAG which corresponds to that. And so you can sort of like read them back. Here's an inflation. The fact of the matter is, I can see from this right away that this is one where the original DAG must consist of A, B, and C, because those are the ones that are appearing in copies. In the original DAG, A and B have this Y, B and C have this Z, right? And it's just there. I mean, this sort of subset just follows. So if your inflation is non-trivial, there's only going to be one original DAG which it's an inflation of.
Right.
I think there are the ways in which
you
can do it. Like it's a trivial case first. If my original DAG was actually two disconnected components and I inflated just one of the components, then obviously sort of all the inequalities I derive will be valid regardless of what the other component was, right? Because they're really just going to refer to the part that was inflated. So in that sense, there'd be sort of many original DAGs, which all led to the same inequalities. It's just those inequalities would only care about the part of the DAG that wasn't changing. But I think even if they were connected, like through some common cause Z, and my inflation split Z into two, then it would mean that sort of all the things that could have been off to the left of Z will satisfy the inequalities we derive. And it's just that those inequalities are only going to refer to observed variables over here on the right of Z, and never to anything on the left. So I think, yes, there'll be like sort of inequalities that pertain to lots of different DAGs, but you know, it's because your inequalities are only talking about a subset of the observables in the DAG. Whereas maybe you could show that if the inequalities really talk about everything, then there's a kind of uniqueness result. Even there, it's not clear whether that's true, but so if like a subgraph of my original graph is the Bell case, and then I derive the Bell inequalities for it. Mm-hmm. There's kind of lots of possibilities for what the rest of the graph might be. I think that all fits in.
Yeah, I guess that's answers the question. Right, like you need many variables for there to be any sort of non-trivial relation, and if it was, the inequality would have to be like algebraically separable with, between the two sets of random variables. Right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, if it refers to both variables, I don't know what kind of separability is going to be pertinent. But
well, I mean, it sounds to me like what you're doing there is you're saying if I have a simple DAG and a more complicated DAG, and I do work where I consider an inflation of the simple DAG, but now I want to draw conclusions about this other more complex DAG, I can do so if I can coarse grain the complex DAG into the simple DAG, so I can sort of take all these variables and just say that they're one thing and fit it in. And so that's just, if I have like two observables and I treat them just as one composite thing, then sure, I can take larger DAGs and fit them in, but I'm just looking at them in a coarse-grained way.
But I think there's other tricks, like if I have some really complex DAG and the only connection to the simple DAG is through one common cause, okay? Then I inflate it and I split the common cause and inflation. So now in my inflation, the complicated DAG and the simple DAG are separate. Any inequalities that I derive on the simple part of the DAG over in the inflation model will still hold in the original connected case. It'll just be that they'll refer over here to this stuff. And they won't say anything about the correlations between the simple variables and the variables that appear on the complex side. So there's a kind of modularity. Like if I have just a common cause connecting two things, I can go, boom, let's split that with inflation. Let's derive some inequalities for this guy over here. Let's derive some inequalities for the guy on the right. And that actually might be a good way of sort of modularizing a very complicated problem. Let's split it every way we can, derive inequalities for the smaller, more tractable problems. Everything you get will still be valid on the original.
Yes.
So you can ignore variables, you can coarse grain variables, but you can also split some of the common causes and just focus on the variables that don't refer to the correlations.
So I mean, to my mind, it seems like if you had like a bilocality scenario, that you could consider chained Bell inequalities, and that would give you a lot of constraints, but there are ones which are more than the chained Bell inequalities.
Probably not
get you.
Yeah. Any more questions? I'll ask my last question. Any hope of generalizing these kinds of techniques to get inequalities that separate quantum from GPT?
Rob, you want to take that? This has been the subject of a lot of confusion. I don't know. There are others who have optimism there.
The way Ellie described it and the way we're describing it in the article is that think of the inflated DAG as another causal possibility, and then just use all your standard tools. But in fact, the way the idea was kind of born was that those copies of a given variable, we were really thinking of as counterfactual possibilities. Like, suppose that this root variable had taken a different value than it actually did. So y1 would be the value that y actually took, and y2 would be the value that it might have taken. And so if you reinterpret all of this inflation stuff as counterfactual alternatives, then these diagrams kind of lie when they say, when you've got a common cause, you shouldn't really think of it as a common cause. It's just more like something that happens to be true in these two possible worlds. So it's sort of a common fact about those two worlds. So ideally, it would be nice to have a different diagram that would sort of explicitly tell you what was about causation and what was about logic. But regardless, if that's the situation, then this obstacle with broadcasting, the no broadcasting theorem, that's just for physical maps. But it's possible that you might be able to say, oh, a broadcasting map, a logical broadcasting map, is appropriate to think about what the quantum state between the real world and the counterfactual worlds are. And maybe you just sort of, you imagine all these broadcasting maps. They're not physical, but they're mathematically definable. And then you impose positivity where you can, and you get some inequalities out, and the hope is that that'll give you some valid quantum inequalities. But yeah, that's just a conjecture at this point.
The reason I'm feeling less optimistic, perhaps, is because there's no reason about imposing positivity constraints where you can. I don't see the distinction between that and starting with inequalities which are true based on these sort of non-broadcasting subsets. Because positivity where you can means that it's a set which does not itself involve any broadcasting. But then that argument should hold for all GPTs. So it's going to require something
so
more than
that step has to be a bit
non-negativity.
I guess one thing you certainly could do is do an inflation that's allowed in GPTs, and then it might just be that there are like known quantum constraints that apply to the inflated day. Do you see what I mean?
Like other techniques.
Right. Like if it has like a bell structure, then you know the series of bounds, or maybe it's somehow easier to apply polynomial relaxations to or whatever. And then your whole argument would apply, right? Like if you have a quantum model for the original DAG, that would imply a quantum model for the no broadcasting inflated one. And then so quantum constraints on that become quantum constraints on the original.
Yeah, so I mean, if you want to take Thurston's inequality and other sort of constraints which are known from other methods and use them as starting constraints on the inflation DAG, sure, you can also just use them on the original DAG.
It might
give you something, but I think an interesting question here is can we tweak the technique so that instead of pulling Thurston's band out of the air, we could just recover it in a self-contained manner. But yeah, it's an idea for use in practice. Yeah, it's good.
All right, last call for questions. If there are any, let's thank Ellie again.